Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kohatkar. Nigeria's general elections, which were postponed by more than a month past their original date because of violence, took place on Saturday and were extended for a day. The chaotic voting over the weekend was marred by violence and accusations of fraud in what could be the closest presidential vote since the country's democratic transition. Incumbent President Goodluck Jonathan faces stiff competition from his closest rival, Muhammadu Buhari, a former military dictator of Nigeria. Voting continued through Sunday in some areas, and results are expected to start trickling in today, and a formal result is expected to be announced on Tuesday. The militant group Boko Haram has escalated a campaign of violence since last year, having killed more than 1,000 people, kidnapped hundreds, and resorted to strapping bombs to children. Over the election weekend, nearly 40 people were reportedly killed by Boko Haram, including one elected representative. My guest is Tom Burgess. He is an award-winning journalist and investigative correspondent for the Financial Times. He's the author of the new book, The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. Welcome to Uprising, Tom.
Hi, good to be with you.
Now, how important are these elections? Nigeria is Africa's largest economy, having surpassed South Africa some years ago. This is Nigeria's most important election, where people are choosing a president, plus members of their House of Representatives and Senate. Is this a very significant election overall?
Well, I'd say two things. I'd say in one sense, yes, it's a vital moment in Nigeria's fragile young democracy. And in another sense, these elections are almost meaningless. Let me explain what I mean. On the first idea, you can just see in the reports from coming up from the streets of Lagos, from the countryside, from across Nigeria, the fervor with which people want to vote and the fervor with which they want to protect their vote after some very heavily rigged elections that we've seen since 1999, when the military gave power back to civilians. And there is a trend towards slightly better elections. There's also a very troubling trend towards repeated post-election violence. And in that sense, it's very important what's going on there now. And there is a distinction, as you said, between the two candidates that's not simply ethnic or religious in terms of how they view Nigeria and how they view the world. In another sense, though, I lived in Nigeria for a couple of years and covered the country and covered some of its upheavals. In another sense, this election means very little, because whether Buhari wins or whether Goodluck Jonathan wins, Nigeria will go on being a petro-state. Nigeria will go on being trapped by its wealth, trapped by the oil that it produces.
And I want to definitely get to that, as well as the thesis of your book. But staying on the election for just a little bit, how seriously have we seen these elections, at least so far, before the results have been announced, to be marred by violence? In 2011, the last election, hundreds of people were killed. This weekend, there was horrific violence, but still seemingly on a lower scale than before.
It's too early, I think, to make that comparison, because the violence generally happens in three distinct phases. There's kind of pre-election violence, which is especially in the Niger Delta and the oil area, but also in other parts of the country, where you have kind of political thugs at the behest of their political masters taking out rivals in the kind of jockeying for position phase. Then there's election day itself, which by most standards seems to have gone pretty well. Some people are dead, but it looks like it's around 20, or maybe a few more than that, which is obviously tragic for them, but pretty good by Nigerian standards. The dangerous moment comes with the results. That's when last time we saw about 700 or 800 people killed, and that will come down to how the big ethnic and religious blocs react to whether Goodluck Jonathan, Southern Christian, retains the presidency, or whether it switches to Buhari, a northern military man.
Now, I understand there were biometric scanners that were distributed throughout the country to verify votes and voters, but election monitors found that there were many still in their packaging, which suggests they might not have been tested. Even the president himself was not recognized by the scanner when he tried to vote. How trustworthy could the results be? I understand it's still early, but given these efforts, is there a way that ordinary Nigerians could trust the results?
Well, I think what we're seeing now, and what a lot of Nigerians are saying, is that what they're watching, what they're having to be even more attentive to this time, is the count itself. Previously, we've seen Nigerian elections rigged at the polling stations, basically either through voter intimidation or the ballot stuffing and techniques like this. That's much harder, it seems. Well, using this biometric voting system, which involves a fingerprint, it makes things slower. As you say, Good Luck Jonathan himself had to be manually registered in the end when his fingerprint wasn't recognised. But I think the worry now, especially because the results are taking slightly longer than was initially advertised, is what is happening at the centralised collation centres in the states and with the Electoral Commission in Abuja. There are even diplomats now making unusually public warnings about what is going on behind in the closed door part of the process, which isn't really altered by having the biometric element of the actual voting.
Well, Tom, how disaffected do Nigerians feel with their current government? Is Good Luck Jonathan's failure to establish peace and prosperity a reason why Buhari might be gaining popularity? And this is a man who has a very a significant background in Nigeria. He's not an unknown quantity. And then there's also Good Luck Jonathan's raising a specter of Buhari turning Nigeria into an Islamic fundamentalist state, kind of playing off of these religious differences. He is Christian, Buhari is Muslim. There's a Christian South and the Muslim North. And there's this attempt continually to use religious or sectarian or ethnic divisions to create breaks and polarizations in the Nigerian public. And I'm wondering how those are playing out on the ground.
Well, I think a lot of people would describe those attempts to paint Buhari as some sort of jihadist as completely ridiculous, given his background, and be quite irresponsible, given, as we've said, the level of violence that we see dressed up in religion and ethnicity after Nigerian elections. To the extent to which Nigerians are frustrated with Good Luck Jonathan, I think, yeah, absolutely. They're deeply frustrated with their whole political class. And that's a bigger question here, the extent to which there is really a genuine choice. As you said, Buhari has run Nigeria before. He ran it in a pretty brutal way. He does have a reputation of being almost uncorruptible, as opposed to some very easily corruptible other leaders that Nigeria has known, but at the same time as a perhaps overly strict autocratic ruler who doesn't take opposition lightly. He says that he's changed. It's now the democratic era, and he would rule accordingly. I think the real question for a lot of Nigerians, it's a very young population in Nigeria, very vibrant. The question for them is the extent to which they're being offered a choice between two members of an elite that can put aside their own ethnic and religious differences, even if they play on others, to ensure the status quo, or whether Buhari really would be a change if he does win.
And let's talk about the role of Boko Haram in this election. As I'd mentioned, they've escalated their tactics, and it's easy for the president, the incumbent, to say, I'm going to protect you from this threat. You should re-elect me. They're trying to undermine Nigeria's democracy. And yet under his rule, Boko Haram has flourished. There was a report in the New York Times about Chad and the Chadian army fighting Boko Haram on Nigerian soil and complaining about the absence of the Nigerian military in taking on this fight. It's not clear if Good Luck Jonathan is really combating Boko Haram pretty significantly. What is the role that Boko Haram is playing in all of this? Are they essentially an anti-democratic force that would like to see elections fail overall?
I think so. I think Boko Haram is effectively a death cult. I mean, you can draw links between Nigeria's kind of oil dependency, its economic collapse, its political corruption, and the rise of Boko Haram. But really, I think it offers a rallying call for disillusioned young men in an extremely poor place whose political leaders have abandoned them for many years. And it's, I think, a cynic would say that the fight back against Boko Haram has only really begun in the last few weeks with the election looming. Indeed, it was used as the pretext to delay the election when the opposition were gathering steam. You mentioned Idris Deby, the Chadian president, no Democrat himself, of course, but he's part of this regional alliance that is now fighting back. There are also South African mercenaries on the ground there. I think something that really brought it home to Nigerians was when there were the attacks on Charlie Hebdo and at the kosher supermarket in Paris in January this year. Goodluck Jonathan and his top people were very quick to get onto Twitter and announce "Je suis Charlie" like the rest of the world. But a few days previously, reports had begun to come out of a village in the Nigerian northeast called Baga, which had seemingly been basically razed by Boko Haram, and there wasn't a word from the government. Similarly, there's 200 young women who went missing from Chibok many months ago now. They appear to most Nigerians simply to have been left to their fate. And there is a broader question, and this is just the sharp end of it, I think, about the extent to which the security services in Nigeria are predators or protectors. In the fight back against Boko Haram, there have been atrocities committed, of course, by Boko Haram, but also by the military.
Well, let's turn to your book. And the issue that is rarely discussed is the framework for these elections. When we look at Nigeria's struggles with democracy, first of all, polls show that ordinary Nigerians are desperate for democracy. They want democracy, which people wouldn't, right? The subtitle of your book, I think, really says it quite clearly. Your book is called The Looting Machine. Subtitle is Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. The underlying issue of Nigeria's economic resources, its oil, its mineral wealth. Is this why we see the kind of political violence and chaos that seems to have no other explanation?
I think it's a mistake always with somewhere as complicated as Nigeria to try and pick one explanation. But yes, I do argue in the book that an enormous reason, and a reason that maybe the outside world ignores too often, for Nigeria's political chaos, for the violence, for the poverty in a country with immense natural wealth, is that wealth itself. And just to give you the most basic explanation, I think the central thing of this is, remember, you know, the famous rallying call of the American revolutionaries, no taxation without representation. You turn that round. How can you have representation? How can you have a government that represents the people if they don't tax the people, if that government is not funded by the people? In Nigeria, 70% of the government's income comes from, at the stroke of a pen, granting rights to foreign oil and gas companies to extract oil from the creeks of the delta and under the seabed. 70% of government income is revenues from oil and gas. About 4% comes from directly taxing the people. If the people don't fund the government, how are they supposed to call it to account? And what you see develop in Nigeria, and it goes for Africa's other petrostates, goes for places like Equatorial Guinea and Angola and the big mineral-rich countries like Congo, is you see a shadow state develop. Yes, there are central banks and education ministries and finance ministries, but they have very little real power. They're often kind of a facade in some way to the outside world. And instead you have cliques that wield real power and who do deals with very large foreign companies that are prepared to pay them enormous bribes. So you have a system where the ruling class, and I think it's demonstrated by the story I told a second ago, about the way the political class in Nigeria basically ignored an enormous massacre in its northeast. The political class becomes detached from the country over which they rule, plugged into international commodity markets, far more in a sense than they're held accountable at home.
Tom, the price of oil in recent months has plunged worldwide. How has that affected Nigeria's economy in terms of the living conditions of ordinary Nigerians? And then in the long term, how that might be feeding Boko Haram?
Well, the immediate impact was on the Nigerian budget. I mean, as I just said, about 70% of the government's income is oil and gas. Mm-hmm. So the oil price halves, that's a big fall in your budget. So they've had to they're having to rein in on some government spending. There's a weird contradiction always when you think about the extent to which this hurts ordinary people. Ordinary people in Nigeria are largely outside the oil economy. They feel the lack of their ability to hold their leadership to account, and they feel these crazy paradoxes like petrol shortages, which could ease, if anything, because the oil price has fallen. In terms of Boko Haram in the north, I'm not sure that you could say the northeastern Nigerian economy is plugged into the oil price to any great extent. I think what you could see is it's effectively a raising of the stakes, right? The pot in the middle has become smaller. The patronage system, which is really what holds Nigeria together, has less oil money to lubricate it. It makes it all the more urgent for people at every level of government to capture what little bit of patronage they can.
And finally, Tom, you write in your book, I started to see the thread that connects a massacre in a remote African village in Nigeria with the pleasures and comforts that we in the richer parts of the world enjoy. What is that thread? How do you make the story of what's happening in Nigeria a relevant one to the rest of the world? Because really, we really ought to consider our own comforts and pleasures as being linked back to Nigeria's mineral wealth.
Yeah, I think I completely agree, and I think it's quite strange that we don't. I mean, we're obsessed with where our coffee comes from, but not our copper, you know, or our oil, or our iron, or our diamonds. Although we've started to twig with this idea of blood diamonds. I think that the supply chains are there for all to see. I mean, until the shale boom in the U.S., Nigeria was the third or fourth biggest supplier of crude to the U.S. You fill up your tank, basically, effectively, given the size of Nigeria's supplies to the world economy, if you fill up your car with petrol, with gas, 50 times, one of those tanks is Nigerian, and that money directly contributes to the poisoning of Nigerian politics and to and in part to the enormous poverty, especially in northern Nigeria and in the Niger Delta. And that pattern is the same in dozens of African states. And we seem much more concerned with keeping out the things from Africa that we don't like, people who may have caught Ebola, refugees, economic migrants, much more concerned with keeping those things out than with realizing our own role in supporting the worst bits of African rule.
Well, Tom, I want to thank you so much for joining us today, and we'll monitor the results from the elections as they become available. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My guest is Tom Burgess. He's an award-winning journalist and a correspondent for the Financial Times. His book is called The Looting Machine: Warlords, Oligarchs, Corporations, Smugglers, and the Theft of Africa's Wealth. This is Uprising. We'll be right back.